Chapter 7 of Walter Youngquist's book Geodestinies. The title of the chapter is Minerals, Money, and the, quote, petrocurrencies, unquote. This chapter might well have been titled Minerals as Money, because during many centuries the two are one and the same. Pieces of gold and silver, and sometimes copper, lead, tin, and zinc were used as money. When people first began to travel relatively long distances from their homeland, they encountered barter systems different from what they had known, and there was a need for a common medium of exchange. Copper ingots were used, as well as smaller pieces of gold, silver, and bronze. Gradually, gold and silver became the preferred metals for exchange, even before coins were invented. Pieces of these metals were passed back and forth among merchants who kept scales for weighing them. In the eyes of many people, gold and silver still remain the only valid form of money, and are called the currencies of last resort. As long as politicians have the records they do in managing nations' finances, good reasons for that view will remain. In India and China, gold and silver are still used as stores of wealth and exchange. There are significant amounts of silver that reside under mattresses in India. Arabs have long placed their ultimate trust in gold. Early oil leases in Saudi Arabia, negotiated by foreign companies, when foreign companies were allowed to lease Saudi oil rights, were paid for in gold at the insistence of the Saudis. The Chinese were the first to use paper money, as early as 1023 AD. Governments have continued to issue paper money at various times, often with mixed, indeed unfortunate, results. Devaluations of paper currencies continue around the world as governments print more money in an attempt to keep their economies going. All too frequently, people who save paper money are the financial losers as their bank deposits continue to devalue. Frequently, the plot of the depreciation of currencies is a declining exponential curve, dropping slowly at first and then accelerating toward the end, and finally becoming a vertical downline as paper currency becomes worthless. This occurred in modern times to the German mark after World War I, when workers had to be paid twice a day. German wives would meet their husbands at the plant's gate at noon to get their pay for that morning so that they could immediately spend it before it lost value by nightfall. More recently, described later in greater detail, the Zimbabwe currency dramatically reflected the same exponential declining curve in its paper money debacle. The devaluation of the currency led the German printer who printed Zimbabwe's money eventually to refuse to do so because the money was worthless. In 2003, the exchange rate was one Zimbabwe dollar to one U.S. dollar. It then inflated to 30,000 Zimbabwe dollars to one U.S. dollar. The government of Robert Mugabe continued to print money until the annual inflation rate reached 11.2%. At that point, the people of Zimbabwe were forced to engage in a barter system of exchange. The use of the Zimbabwean dollar as an official currency was effectively abandoned on April 12, 2009, when the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe legalized the use of foreign currencies for transactions. The South African rand, Botswana pula, British pound sterling, and the U.S. dollar are used instead. This ignited an economic boom in the once prosperous African country. Honest money equals store of value. To be money in the true sense, money has to be a store of value whereby one person's goods or services can be exchanged for money, and that money later can be exchanged for goods or services of equal value. If inflation intervenes between these two transactions, paper money fails to retain its value. Inflation is the order of economic life today. It is one way that governments finance themselves by selling bonds fixed in denomination. When bonds mature and are paid off in whatever currency they were issued, it is almost always a depreciated currency. The original value is lost. The noted Swiss financial expert Franz Pick, publisher of Pick's World Currencies, defined a government bond as, quote, assured confiscation of your money, unquote. On the other hand, gold and silver have proven to be much more dependable. paper money at times has actually seen its value decrease by half in more than just a matter of days, as in the German inflation in the early 1920s. In Brazil, Peru, Chile, Mexico, Zimbabwe, and a number of other nations, inflation has often exceeded 100% a year. The extent to which paper money can become virtually worthless is striking. When I visited the Soviet Union shortly before its breakup, the ruble's official exchange was the U.S. $1.60 U.S. dollars to one. After the breakup of the USSR, the ruble went to 5,000 to the dollar. Then the Russian government issued a new ruble, whose current exchange rate is 31 rubles to the dollar. A number of years ago in Chile, I took a local bus ride through Valparaiso to see the town. I had some local currency, but not knowing the bus fare, I simply handed the driver a couple of large denomination bills. His cash register was just the dashboard of the bus. He reached over and grabbed some bills and handed them to me without counting them. It was a windy day, and at the next stop, two people got on and some of the money on the dashboard blew out the door. Nobody bothered to chase it. The old peso at that time was worth approximately 15,000 to the dollar. It was later replaced by the escudo, which suffered the same inflationary fate as the peso. Chile is now using a quote-unquote new peso, and the U.S. dollar currently buys 550 Chilean pesos. Such wild fluctuations do not happen with silver or gold, which are as true a store of value as anything we now know. The Chilean peso value today benefits from the high price of copper Chile exports. Printing paper versus mining minerals. It takes energy to wring gold, silver, copper, and zinc from the earth, and to smelt and refine them. It takes much less energy to cut down a tree, process it into numerous pieces of paper, and then print some numbers on the pieces of paper and call it money. Unlike a gold coin that has a fixed gold content, 1 ounce, for example, a piece of paper can be printed in any denomination. No other figure than 1 ounce can legitimately be stamped onto a 1 ounce gold coin, but governments can and do print any number they wish on a piece of paper. It has no tangible backing. Johannes Gutenberg, with his invention of the printing press, greatly facilitated paper inflation. Every politician who votes for deficit spending should have a shrine to Gutenberg in his office. His invention, in the hands of fiscally irresponsible governments, has destroyed the life savings of many people around the world, continues to do so, and will inevitably do so in the future as national debts become so large that they cannot be paid off honestly. Metal coins. Barter was the original means of exchange, and things such as shells and precious and semi-precious stones and sacks of grain were used. But the value of various barter items was not fixed, and therefore it was difficult to use them to trade in different places. Pieces of gold and silver were also used, but their random sizes made it difficult to easily determine their value. They had to be weighed, and their purity varied. Eventually, the concept of coins made of a valuable metal with a fixed amount of metal in each coin and the amount of the metal in the coin made known created a consistent value and stable medium for exchange of goods. The time when metal coins were first used is uncertain. They may have started in China as near as history can tell, a likely possibility as the Chinese seem to have been first in many things. Interestingly enough, soon after the Chinese began issuing precious metal coins, other Chinese began to make them wholly or partly out of lead. So it may be also that the Chinese can be given credit for inventing the lead nickel, or counterfeiting in general. This counterfeiting became so rampant that Chinese officials ultimately decreed that anyone caught operating a lead mine without government sanction would be executed. The first coins in what is now Europe were struck of the Greek city-state of Lydia during the 7th century BC. Wherever they originated, coins have a varied history. Once coins began to be accumulated along with precious metal ingots, they became military objectives. They were rich booty in the conventional form. The capture of state treasuries, such as the Persian, the Babylonian, and the Greek, were major military objectives. Along with slaves, the gold and silver booty was paraded through the streets of the victors. The parade of precious metals and slaves vividly illustrates the importance of two things that are still vital for civilization: mineral and energy resources. Slaves at that time represented energy in useful form. Salary, S-A-L-A-R-Y. After Greece, Rome became the dominant power in the Mediterranean area. Rome did this by developing a large and well-disciplined army. The soldiers were given a ration of salt as part of the monthly payment for their services. From this, we have the expression, "Is he worth his salt?" The fact that payment was partially in salt and delivered in regular installments gave rise to the term salary, derived from the Latin word sal, for salt. Rome, precious metals, and money. The Italian peninsula has a fine climate, but it is markedly deficient in precious metals. To pay the army with something besides salt, Rome needed gold and silver. Some was obtained from looting the Greek treasuries, but that source ultimately dwindled. However, when Rome defeated Carthage, among the spoils of the wars was a province known as Spania, now called Spain. The Roman military returned with much gold and silver from Spain. Rome also took possession of the mines that produced those metals. At one time, the Romans had 40,000 miners working Spain's silver deposits, sending all the metal to Rome. Silver ultimately became the main metal of Roman coinage, and the unit of exchange was the denarius. The Italian peninsula, as noted, had very little in the way of precious metals, so it was the Spanish mines as well as the Greek gold and silver that financed Rome's armies, making Rome the dominant power in the then-known civilized world, Western world. Wealthy Romans had luxurious villas overlooking the various bays of the Mediterranean. They also had beautiful homes on the south shore of the Mediterranean, for they had taken over parts of North Africa, including what are now Libya and Tunisia. The Romans loved luxury, and the gold and silver captured by their armies and that produced from mines worked by slaves in conquered lands provided the money to pay for the imports that Rome needed. Paper money had not yet been invented, so Rome could not run a deficit in its balance of trade as nations do today. Precious metals were the only medium of exchange. Ultimately, the precious metals from the Spanish mines became the chief source of money for Rome, and continued to be for many decades. Gradually, a difficulty arose. The mines got deeper and deeper, and the problem of water flooding in the mines became increasingly hard to manage. The Romans were quite ingenious about solving this for a time. Ultimately, they were unable to invent adequate systems or pumps to remove the water. Finally, the ore that could be reached in the mines was exhausted. There were many causes for the fall of the Western Roman Empire, but one contributing factor surely was the erosion of the value of Roman currency. For three centuries, the gold mines of Spain produced more than 300,000 ounces annually. Spain's silver mines produced even more metal. With the depletion of the mines, Rome's treasury emptied. Rome continued to issue debased coins to pay the army, which became an entirely mercenary force. Rome's sons were no longer drafted, as they had been during the Republican era. Roman emperors hired others to take their place. Debasing the coin of the realm. The loyalty of Rome's mercenary army had to be purchased, and the army insisted on being paid in something of value. In 9 AD, the Emperor Augustus was unable to replace the army of his general Varius, which was destroyed by the Germans. The Roman answer to the lack of silver and gold for their coins was to begin to debase the coins by adding other metals, chiefly lead and copper. In a period of only 50 years, the denarius fell from being about 70% silver to only about 10% silver. As the denarius was losing its standing, a new coin, the Antinonius, was issued, and also the double denarius, but the latter contained only 50% silver. When civil wars broke out, the expenses caused a monetary crisis, and the silver coin was further debased and dropped to 5% silver content. In 50 years, the denarius had fallen to less than one-tenth of its original value. But the citizenry and army were not deceived. If you revisit the museum at Sabrentha, the site of the ancient Roman city a short distance west of modern Tripoli, Libya, you will see an interesting display of Roman coins. The earlier coins are pure silver and gold, but the later coins, although carrying the same stamped face value, were debased. The citizens, the merchants, and the army all knew about the cheapening of the coins. To compensate for the inflation of their money, they clipped the earlier, more valuable coins to, in some cases, merely narrow pie slice shaped pieces to equal the value of the later debased coins. On the wall where these coins are mounted, you can see narrow slices of earlier pure precious metal coins that remained in circulation and which were equal in value to the silver content of the later, still round, but debased coins. It is a visual display of inflation and currency debasement. The same display could be mounted in many other countries today. As Will and Ariel Durant wrote, quote, "History is inflationary," unquote. The earlier Roman coinage with its pure precious metal content was the most highly prized and valued currency of its time in the Mediterranean region. However, as precious metal supplies dwindled, the debasement of the coins proceeded. As the government continued to try to pass these debased coins at full value, Roman currency became a despised currency, and the prestige of the Roman government also declined. This is a lesson not to be forgotten, and may have contemporary parallels. By the 4th century AD, the situation was so bad, with Roman coins of varying degrees of debasement in circulation, that it was necessary to weigh and assess each coin. In these circumstances, Roman currency became virtually worthless. The mercenary Roman legions could not be properly paid, and their loyalty to the government was undermined with the sharp reduction of silver and gold content from the coins. With a debased currency no longer accepted by merchants, Roman citizens could not import the luxuries they once employed. Rome's chief export had long been money accumulated during earlier centuries when they had acquired access to precious metals through conquest. Romans surrendered this wealth because they had few other options of value with which to trade. Rome depended on plunder instead of creating wealth, and when this policy began to fail, Rome went into decline. Poss makes an interesting observation, perhaps with modern parallels. Quote, "This imbalance in trade contributed greatly to Rome's ultimate ruin. Paying for lavish quantities of imports in amounts that exceeded exports, with a currency that had been depreciating since the Punic Wars, and further debased by such emperors as Nero, Aurelius, Commodus, Caracalla, and Servius, Rome's currency was becoming unacceptable. The empire's trading capital, the basis for its economic life, was being destroyed. With Rome thus facing economic disintegration, nothing could have added greater distress than the withering of her metallic supplies. Germanic hordes everywhere were rising in constant revolt. They began to overrun provinces of the empire, pillaging Gaul, Spain, Macedonia, Cyprus, and Asia Minor, long the storehouses of Rome's invaluable mineral deposits," unquote. By 218 AD, the Roman emperor Aglapius decided to make the denarius wholly of copper. This coin was not accepted by the eastern merchants, which was a great blow because Rome had been the empire's trading center and the focus of its economic life. By the year 2020 AD, silver was so scarce that the debased currency could no longer be supported, and the government repudiated its debts. This resulted in Rome's fall as a trade center of consequence and the inability of the government to pay for itself or the military. Finally, with northern hordes beating on its doors and no money of value to pay for defense, the Roman Empire collapsed. The debasement of the currency was only one of the reasons for Rome's fall, but it was a very important one. It may have been the single most important one. The Roman historian Antonius Augustus wrote, quote, "Money has more to do with the distemper of the Roman Empire than the Huns or the Vandals," unquote. The gold standard. Allowing paper money to be freely converted to gold is called the gold standard. This prevents governments from printing paper money that does not have gold backing and thus restrains politicians from excessive spending. By the 1870s, most major nations of the world had adopted the gold standard. The United States was one of the last, adopting it in 1900. Until the Great Depression of the 1930s in the United States, the dollar was tied to the price of gold. That is, the dollar could be converted to gold at a fixed rate. As long as the price of gold remained fixed, which it was for many years, first at $20 an ounce and then briefly at $35 an ounce, there was confidence in the U.S. dollar because it could at any time be redeemed in gold. Because of this, the government could not simply print money because the money had to have gold behind it. But the many government programs the Roosevelt administration in the United States initiated during the 1930s required that more dollars be printed. The Gold Standard Act in the United States, passed in 1900 and officially repealed in 1971, was for all practical purposes invalidated when President Roosevelt signed the Gold Reserve Act of 1934. This measure provided that the dollar could no longer be converted into gold, and the government prohibited the manufacture of gold coins. This meant that a private money system based on gold coins could not be established. And now, in 2012, it takes $1,700 to buy an ounce of gold. Gold has maintained its value while the paper dollar has not. The price of gold simply shows how much the government has inflated the currency since it left the gold standard. Silver continued to back some U.S. currency with the circulation of silver certificates. However, in 1965, the United States offered to redeem all silver certificates with silver and then took silver out of the coinage. Silver coins were becoming more valuable in terms of inflated paper currency than their stamped face value. Gresham's Law took over. Bad money drives out good money. Silver coins at the time speedily were taken out of circulation as people searched their change for these bits of real money. The new coinage was nickel and copper, and later even copper pennies was replaced by the much cheaper zinc. Try to find a U.S. silver coin dated 1964 or earlier in circulation today. With copper-coated zinc pennies, how far down can the debasement of a metal currency go? Ultimately, it may even be that zinc is too valuable for pennies. Then what? The paper dollar no longer has any precious metal restraint, as inflation since that time clearly shows. There's currently little prospect that a gold standard resulting in some financial discipline will be instituted. The official U.S. government link between the precious metals and money is gone. No other nation maintains this link either. A gold standard might have avoided several debacles of currencies around the world, but the political environments make such monetary restraint impossible. Budgets based on paper money can be financed easily with the printing press. By voting for generous public spending, politicians in effect use the public treasury as a campaign fund, the pork in the budget. Largesse gets them reelected, and most incumbents retain their seats in elections. Paper money ensures continued inflation depreciation of the currency. Abandoning the gold standard. By calling in all gold coins held by its citizens, the United States abandoned the gold standard in 1934. Foreign governments could still buy U.S. gold at the official price, which at the time was $35 an ounce. France started doing so and began draining U.S. gold reserves. To stop this, the U.S. officially left the gold standard in 1971, removing the last remnant of any precious metal backing for the U.S. dollar for any person or government. The Federal Reserve System. The U.S. Federal Reserve System was established in 1913 by an act of Congress. It is a private entity composed of 12 Federal Reserve banks owned by regional banks. No longer constrained by the gold standard, Congress can now vote for any expenditure. Money needed for various social and economic programs, as well as military costs, can be financed by the sale of government bonds to individuals, domestic banks, and foreign governments, notably China. Money not raised otherwise can be obtained from the Federal Reserve, which, upon buying the bonds, then prints money in payment to the government. The government uses that printed paper for its quote-unquote money. Many people do not know this, but the fact can be verified by simply looking at any U.S. paper currency and seeing that it is a Federal Reserve note. In this fashion, the government can finance its needs simply by printing bonds and selling them to the Federal Reserve. abolishing the Federal Reserve System has been a plank in the platform of at least one presidential candidate who denounces it as the greatest existing threat to sound money. Congress determines what to finance, and since social and economic programs, so-called entitlements, are more popular and win more votes than raising taxes does, the national debt, now more than $15 trillion, increases as we continue to live beyond our means. The same is true for many countries and is the cause of the financial crisis that swept across the Eurozone countries beginning in 2010. The problem is that borrowed money should be paid back in money of equal value, but it rarely, if ever, is. The American Institute for Economic Research has shown that if the 1945 U.S. dollar is taken at face value for purchasing power, by 2009 its purchasing power shrank to 6 cents. What backs the U.S. dollar now? If anything backs the U.S. dollar now, it is the country's manufacturing capacity, the ingenuity of its people, e.g. advanced electronics and medical devices, sophisticated forms of heavy equipment, airplanes, and its natural resources. Chief among these is the remaining minerals, its forests, and especially its fertile soil and fresh water supplies related to agricultural productivity. The United States is the world's largest source of corn. China is a major buyer of corn, for which they need U.S. dollars. Alan Greenspan, who later became the chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve Board from 1987 to 2006, commented on the gold standard, quote, "Under a gold standard, the amount of credit that an economy can support is determined by the economy's tangible assets, since every credit instrument is ultimately a claim on some tangible asset. But government bonds are not backed by tangible wealth, only by the government's promise to pay out of future tax revenues. Thus, government's deficit spending under a gold standard is severely limited. The abandonment of the gold standard made it possible for the welfare states to use the banking system as a means to an unlimited expansion of credit. There are now more claims outstanding than real assets. In the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect savings from confiscation through inflation. There is no safe store of value. The financial policy of the welfare state requires that there be no way for owners of wealth to protect themselves. Deficit spending is simply a scheme for the hidden confiscation of wealth. Gold stands in the way of this insidious process. If one grasps this, one has no difficulty understanding the statist's antagonism toward the gold standard." Unquote. Gold in mid-June 2012 was selling for over $1,600 an ounce, its price reflecting how the market values the dollar. As printing paper money continues, the price of gold will serve as an index of inflation, the depreciation of the dollar. Viewing the current scene, some investment advisors suggest gold will be $3,000 an ounce by 2030 or earlier, and silver will be $100 an ounce as turbulent economic times continues. Borrowing and printing money allows nations to live beyond their means, but it cannot continue indefinitely. Debts must be recognized and either repaid or defaulted. The result is likely to be a lower standard of living. The danger from ever-growing debt is that the amount of money needed to pay the interest on the debt eventually becomes so large that it crowds out financing needed for basic government services. The options are threefold. One, reduce the debt by austerity measures, including higher taxes imposed on the public, or, as has nearly always been the case, to either two, print money to the point of high inflation to pay off the debt in cheap dollars, thus destroying citizen savings, or three, repudiate the debt, i.e. default. The latter two options amount to the same thing, causing collapse of the economic system and resulting in economic, social, and political chaos. The dollar now is backed only by, quote, the full faith and credit of the United States, unquote. China has a multi-billion dollar trade surplus with the United States. To keep the U.S. as a strong market for their products, China has been buying about 30% of all U.S. government-issued securities. But there are signs that may change. The Chinese are using their surplus U.S. dollars to buy tangible assets, which recently included the purchase of IBM's personal computer business and oil and metal deposits around the world. They would rather have technical expertise and oil than U.S. paper securities. This trend could eventually have serious repercussions for the United States. Paper as money, quote unquote. The end form of money, so-called money, is paper. There is nothing cheaper to use when for a medium of exchange. In Hong Kong, before its reunification with China, when you exchanged your money for local currency and the final figure had some pennies left over, you received slips of paper, Hong Kong pennies. How much longer will pennies be minted in the United States? Only until the dollar depreciates to the point where there is no metal that can be produced for the size of a penny and still be worth less than a penny. Copper did not survive, and zinc will be the next to go. Analysts are now calling on the Federal Treasury to abandon the metal penny and round off purchase prices to the nearest nickel. Worldwide use of paper money. Gradually around the world, paper money has taken the place of gold and silver. Some countries still cling in various small ways to precious metals for their currencies, chiefly by issuing special coins for special events or occasions. But now all countries, including the major nations, issue paper money not backed by gold or silver. Unfortunately for the general public, paper money as a store of value has a very poor history. Not only is paper money subject to government printing press inflation, but it can also be more easily counterfeited than precious metals currency. As governments no longer back their currencies with precious metals, the evidence of inflation is incontrovertible. It is estimated that if the paper money now in circulation in the world were backed by gold, that gold would be worth $32,000 per ounce. Governments have abandoned precious metals as currency backing because it restricts the government's ability to print an infinite amount of so-called money. Miami Herald Humor columnist Dave Barry has analyzed the situation precisely, stating, quote, "Over the years, all the governments in the world, having discovered that gold is, like, rare, decided it would be more convenient to back their money with something easier to come by, namely, nothing." How other minerals back currencies? Besides precious metals, other things can and do, in effect, back a nation's currency to some extent. The ability to produce cars, food, refrigerators, medicine, medical equipment, and many other items tends to support a nation's money, and therefore the materials from which these things are made, including soil, iron, and copper, and energy uses in the ground, energy resources in the ground, coal, oil, gas, are valuable. Japan, which has very few natural resources, nevertheless has a strong currency. The yen has been strong because of what the Japanese can do by processing and upgrading the natural resources that they import. But their economy is precarious, for without basic raw materials within their borders, they are vulnerable, and they know it. Before World War II, Japan invaded Manchuria, China, and Southeast Asia to establish a colonial empire from which to obtain raw materials. They were defeated in this endeavor. Now they are buying mineral resources abroad, either by 100% ownership or, more often, through joint mineral resource developments. China is doing the exact same thing. Noting the strength of the Chinese yen in international markets, the U.S. Bureau of Mines reported in 1994, quote, "Japan has intensified its overseas mineral exploration and development projects for copper, gold, lead, silver, and zinc since 1992. Significant joint exploration and development projects were undertaken in Australia, Chile, China, Mexico, Mongolia, and the Republic of South Africa, and in the United States. In 1992, Japan successfully launched its first geological observation satellite with the world's most advanced sensor and radar equipment to aid in the worldwide search for copper, gold, iron, lead, zinc, silver, and other metals. The satellite began transmitting data in 1993, covering 10 portions of the Earth's surface, including two targeted areas in the United States." Unquote. In this way, Japan is working to establish, through legitimate economic means, a worldwide network of mineral supply sites to replace colonies it could not seize by military force. Despite that, what really backs the Japanese yen is Japan's industry, its ability to process earth materials into useful items, many of which now offer keen competition to the American automobile industry. Petrocurrencies. There is no better example of how the possession of mineral and energy mineral resources supports the value of a nation's money than in the case of oil. As oil became more and more important in world economies, and clearly was the only thing making the money of some countries valuable in world trade, Nigeria, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Libya, and others, the concept of petrocurrencies developed. When Kuwait's chief resource lies beneath its desert sands in the form of oil several times longer than the amount of oil in the United States, there can hardly be a better reason for holding the Kuwait dinar. Among the Gulf states, oil provides about 80% of government revenues. In North Africa, Libya has virtually no other resources than oil, and the Libyan dinar floats on the surface of the ocean of world's currencies because it floats on oil. When the oil is gone, the value of the Libyan dinar will likely vanish. Oil and the British pound. The same is true to some degree for the British pound since the discovery of oil in the British sector of the North Sea. With that discovery and subsequent British self-sufficiency in oil, and for a brief time a net oil exporter, the British pound did a great deal better than in times past. It has had its problems, however, which were clearly tied to oil. In the 1980s, when the price of oil declined, the British pound dropped to the point that it almost equaled a dollar. Then, as oil prices rose, so did the pound. Clearly, an example of the importance of possessing that energy mineral resource to the value of the British currency. Former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's greatest stroke of good luck was probably the coincidence of her early tenure with the surplus foreign exchange account the government ran on the basis of oil production and export. This helped Mrs. Thatcher become the Prime Minister with the longest tenure in recent British history. Without North Sea oil revenue, the government's budget deficit would have been much higher, and it would have required income tax increases of between $30 and $35 billion. That's pounds converted to dollar equivalent. There would have been another million people added to Britain's jobless lines, which undoubtedly would have contributed to considerable civil strife. Over the longer term, North Sea oil has given Britain a lasting legacy in the form of some £80 billion of foreign investments that Britain made at the time it had the oil money to do it. This was earned as new oil fields were discovered and oil prices went up and up. When oil prices slumped in the mid-1980s, the income from oil declined to the point when, in 1986, the income from investments made earlier from oil money exceeded the direct income received from oil. This, again, tended to support the British currency and economy. Britain, however, has come close to killing the goose, which has been laying the golden, or in this case, the oil-filled egg. The average tax rate, when adjusted for inflation, is about 78% of the profits of the oil companies. For some oil fields, the rate is over 90%. With such a high tax, companies refused to develop the many small field discoveries that were made, with the result that Britain passed the peak of its oil production in the late 1990s. The hope for future development lies in more than 40 smaller fields, some with only 1/20th the recoverable oil of the larger fields. As one observer said, quote, "The government milked hell out of this industry and the cow nearly fell down," unquote. Recently, the British government reduced its tax rate on all new fields, with the result that some of the smaller discoveries are now being developed. Just a note. However, this additional production cannot make up for the decline in the larger fields, and production continues to drop. In 2004, Great Britain recorded the steepest drop of any oil-producing country, with oil extraction down 10%. The downward trend has continued. Forecasts are that oil production will fall 1/3 from its peak by 2020. Such a dramatic change is certain to cause budget problems for the future prime minister. Britain is now a net importer of both oil and natural gas. At the moment, the pound is fairly strong, but will it remain so with increasing imports of petroleum? Margaret Thatcher picked the right time to be prime minister. Canada. It seems odd to think of the Canadian dollar as a petrocurrency. It would be the only such currency outside the Gulf countries and Venezuela. But Canada is the largest exporter of oil to the world's largest importer of oil, the United States. The Canadian dollar has been slowly increasing in value against the U.S. dollar. With the world's largest deposits of oil sands and conventional oil more difficult to find, billions of dollars are pouring into these resources from investors in several countries. Oil sands are likely to be the last surviving oil industry in North America. With oil, timber, and metals, Canada's dollar is now a natural resource dollar. Oil and U.S. balance of payments. The United States, unfortunately, is increasingly on the wrong side of oil balance of payments relationships. In the late 1980s and into the 1990s, the value of the U.S. dollar plunged to a record post-war low against other major currencies. The main reason for this was the large balance of payments deficits, combined with a huge budget deficit at home. A significant part of the trade deficit resulted from the cost of importing oil and other raw materials. The situation became even more acute in the first decade of the 21st century. At present, the United States imports about 11 million barrels of oil a day. No refineries have been built in the United States in over 20 years. With limited U.S. refining capacity, an increasing percentage of oil is imported as more costly refined products, gasoline, jet fuel, and diesel. About 8% of U.S. oil imports are now finished product. At 11 million barrels of oil a day, at an average cost of over $80 a barrel, the U.S. Oil import bill is more than $750 million daily. The United States' dollar's sensitivity to oil was illustrated when a rumor came out that an exploration project had struck oil in the Baltimore Canyon area off the east coast of the United States. This had long been a major exploration target. The dollar immediately jumped in value. When the rumor proved false, and the Baltimore Canyon area has now been one of the great disappointments in east coast offshore drilling, the dollar fell. Just as oil-rich countries are kept afloat by oil, insufficient oil in a country that uses 25% of the world's supply, as the U.S. does, depresses its currency. This is likely to be an increasing problem for the United States because oil remains the largest single component of the U.S. deficit in international balance of payments. It is true that some of the money sent abroad to buy oil comes back to purchase goods or assets of various sorts. But the United States is in a losing situation. As the petrodollars get recycled, the U.S. may not see much benefit because U.S. exports to the OPEC members remain weak. Also, the U.S. may not gain from new capital flows. Although there is no hard data, some reports suggest that in the current geopolitical climate, petrodollar investments are flowing increasingly to euro-based assets. The dollar is under stress as oil figures into the cost of nearly everything. Money and international prestige. As the U.S. dollar falls, some politicians and industrialists applaud because presumably it makes U.S. exports more competitive. But the low-value dollar is a two-edged sword. If the U.S. has a big balance of payments deficit, that is, it imports more than it exports. The cheap dollar makes imports more expensive, and the single main import is oil. If the United States dollar weakens, the prestige of the United States weakens too. No one respects a country in which it takes a handful of money to buy a loaf of bread. Citizens traveling abroad want to have a currency that is respected and in demand, and has reasonable buying power relative to similar goods at home. The disaster that overtook the Russian ruble after the Soviet Union disintegrated certainly did not enhance Russia's international prestige. Now, with Russia becoming a major gas exporter, especially to Europe, the ruble is strengthening. The value of a currency and how it is respected is a considerable measure of that country's political strength and economic influence around the world. It has been said that the market valuation of a nation's currency is an international report card on how well that country is managed. Testifying before the United States Congress in 1995, Felix Rotatin, a senior partner in the investment firm Lazard Fares, stated, quote, "We are gradually losing control of our own destiny. The dollar's decline undercuts American economic leadership and prestige. It is perhaps the single most dangerous economic threat we will face in the long term because it puts us at the mercy of other countries, unquote. Since then, the U.S. economic situation has continued to deteriorate. The dollar has been the reserve currency of the world since the end of World War II. Most international accounts, including the purchase of and sale of oil and all other commodities, are now settled in dollars. But there is an ominous trend emerging. In 1965, 80% of the world's foreign currency reserve holdings were in dollars. By 1995, that figure had declined to about 58%. Oil priced in dollars. Because of the continued weakness of the dollar, the oil-producing countries have suggested that oil should be priced in terms of a basket of currencies, that is, by using the average value of several currencies. If oil is no longer priced in U.S. dollars, it would be a severe blow both to U.S. prestige and to the dollar. The fact that the most important commodity in world trade, oil, is priced in U.S. dollars is a major reason why the dollar is the most widely accepted currency in the world. Although the huge oil import bill for the United States is not the only culprit destroying the dollar's reputation as a strong currency, it is an important one. If at some point a major oil exporting country decides to price its product in some other currency, the international repercussions would be large and could set off an unfortunate train of events for the dollar. In fact, there is already a basket of currencies in the form of the euro, a currency in use by most European countries, markets important to OPEC. Oil will continue to be the largest single item in the U.S. import bill for the foreseeable future. Continuing to price oil in dollars is very important to the United States. For Muslim countries, which hold most of the remaining world oil and are disenchanted with the United States, switching to the euro or some other monetary system for pricing their oil would give them another economic weapon besides oil itself. Oil backs local credit. In some states of the United States, oil is also a proxy for money in the way that state bonds are rated and how easily they can be sold. A brokerage house titles one of its investment publications, General Obligation Credits in the Oil Patch, which indicates oil production remains a strong factor in the economies and budgets of states such as Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and notably Alaska. In the first three of these states, bond ratings were lowered when the price of oil dropped and oil production and exploration activity declined. Alaska's good fortune for the moment. Thanks to the Prudhoe Bay's strong oil production, Alaska's bond ratings were raised in 1980 and have not been reduced since. But as Prudhoe Bay extraction declines, and if no other substantial oil fields are found in Alaska, its bond ratings will be reviewed. More than any other state, Alaska's budget is tied directly to the petroleum industry. Revenues from oil and gas make up about 86% of total state government income. Bond ratings are important because they determine the interest to be paid on bonds. A good bond rating is worth money to the organization that issues them. If it is oil that gives the bond a good rating, then oil is worth money to the bond issuer. Oil via dollars equals an international currency. Oil, as noted, is priced and paid for internationally in dollars. As long as the dollar is strong enough to be wanted around the world, the dollar makes a country's budget easier to handle by providing universally acceptable foreign exchange and reduces pressures on the local currency to carry that load. If the oil money were not there, it would almost certainly take much more of a local currency to buy anything on the international market. Oil being priced and sold in dollars gives each oil-producing country money that is recognized as money around the world, despite the condition of its own currency. Oil money benefits other countries. Oil money not only aids the Middle East countries that have the oil, but also benefits the people that work in that region who come from countries that do not have much oil themselves. Indian, Pakistani, and other foreign workers in the oil-rich Middle East nations send substantial sums back to their home countries. Egypt has some oil production, but with a rapidly growing population of 83 million, it is increasingly dependent for its survival on foreign aid, from neighboring friendly oil-rich Arab countries, chief of which are Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. But when the oil revenues of its rich neighbors begin to decline, Egypt will no longer be able to be supported as it is now. Perhaps the situation will not be played out for some time, since both Kuwait and Saudi Arabia have very large oil reserves, and they have been generous to their Muslim Arab neighbors. However, as the oil begins to run out in these two countries, they will no doubt look to their own interests first, as with all the other oil-endowed countries. Editor's note from Michael Dowd here in 2016, another concern has got to be the fact that there's a huge push among some that in the next 10 to 20 years, we completely get off fossil fuels, which would have unspeakably large ramifications. Another oil-deficient Arab state benefiting from its oily neighbors is Jordan. It gets a little export income from some small phosphate deposits. It has become a gold trading center in the Arab world. On the streets of downtown Amman, Jordan's capital, robed Arab men and women may be seen frequenting gold shops. Arabs have long been putting their confidence in gold. Many have gotten wealthy on oil, but taking a longer view, they invest in gold as something that will last beyond the oil. Perhaps they rightly do not trust any of the currencies of the world as reliable stores of value. The gold trade in Amman is brisk. Minerals provide foreign exchange for small economies. Many smaller countries whose economies are not big enough to justify the absence of an automobile plant, an electronics complex, laboratory facilities for production of vital medical supplies, or other sorts of manufacturing, which must have a reasonably large domestic market to survive, urgently need foreign exchange. Without a diversified industrial base, foreign exchange has to fill the gap to pay for imported items. Where oil is not available to earn money, metals and other minerals may provide the foreign exchange so urgently needed. Peru, Bolivia, Zaire, and Zambia, for example, do not have a diversified manufacturing base. Many things have to be imported. These countries are not highly developed technologically, and therefore cannot sell technology or the things technology produces. Accordingly, these lesser developed countries must fall back upon the production of raw materials, commonly minerals, to earn much of their foreign exchange. Bolivia earns its foreign exchange from the sale of tin, oil, and gas. Peru earns most of its foreign exchange from exports of gold, silver, copper, and little oil. It will soon earn more foreign exchange from the sale of gas from its large Camisí gas field east of the Andes, following the completion of the Trans-Andean pipeline and the export terminal on the coast. Zambia's copper provides more than 80% of its foreign exchange. Chile's currency, like most Latin America currencies, has been volatile. But its volatility would have been even greater if it had not been for the fact that it has some of the largest and richest copper deposits in the world. Copper exports currently account for 54% of its foreign exchange income, and copper will earn valuable foreign exchange for Chile for many years to come. The dire need to export something to earn foreign exchange also tends to disrupt mineral resource markets. Chile, with its relatively rich copper ores and low-cost labor, can produce that red metal at an average cost of less than 60 U.S. cents a pound, substantially below current production costs in the United States. Even if Chile had to sell its copper at a loss, it would do so because it needs foreign exchange at almost any price. At times, Chile has dumped large amounts of copper on the market despite low prices and demand. The result has been that many copper mines in the U.S. had to close. On the other hand, the money Chile earns goes in part to pay interest on the $20 billion foreign debt owed by Chile, much of it held by U.S. banks. It is a complicated, interlocking financial world that mineral resource economics creates. Another aspect of some countries' dependence on the export of minerals or energy minerals is that as the price of these materials drops, they need to export more to maintain the same level of income. However, by exporting more, they cause lower prices, and so on it goes. Countries often need to export minerals not only to obtain foreign exchange, but also to provide internal employment. By having to produce more because of declining prices to earn the same amount of foreign exchange, there is some compensation because they create more employment. This has the advantage of keeping the local population reasonably content and benefits the political regime in power, even if the price of the product falls below the cost of production in a given country. That country is still likely to continue production or extraction, which is in 2016 exactly what's happening, where the oil is like $30 a barrel, which is beneath production, and yet these countries still have to produce. At first glance, this does not seem logical, but the economics were neatly explained by a minister of mines in one African nation who commented on a gold mining project that was uneconomical by most standards. He said, quote, "You do not understand. As long as the metal brings in more dollars than we have to spend for supplies from the outside, it is economic. The labor, power, and other supplies are obtained locally and paid for in our currency, the value of which we control. We need the thousands of jobs to keep the people quiet. Therefore, the project is economic," unquote. So it is not just the matter of earning foreign exchange that causes fluctuations in the price of minerals and energy minerals. It's also politics. The amount of the resource produced is increased simply to keep things going. The things, in many cases, is the current political regime, which may involve considerable graft to keep the present politicians in power. If the graft is not kept properly fueled with money, there are likely to be changes. Heads may literally roll. Some of the cheating on OPEC production quotas may have its origin in these circumstances. Domestic oil saves foreign exchange. Being self-sufficient in oil does make a difference, a lot of difference. If the United States were still self-sufficient in oil and had not sent billions of dollars abroad to pay for oil, it would not be such a huge international debtor as it is now. It was the increasing dependence of the U.S. on foreign oil that enabled the OPEC countries to raise the price of oil as high as they did in the past. This resulted in a great transfer of the Western world's wealth to them, causing tidal waves in international banking. No doubt the price of oil would have increased anyway, but the extent to which it rose would have been less if the United States, the world's largest consumer of oil, had been self-sufficient in oil. This is another example of oil as money and the problems that beset a highly industrialized, high oil consuming nation. Oil money in the banking system. Minerals, oil in particular, have had a far more profound effect on the world economic system and its structure than simply influencing the value of a particular currency or providing a foreign exchange medium. When the price of oil was raised from less than $3 a barrel to more than $35 a barrel, the world witnessed the biggest transfer of wealth in all of history, and it continues with oil at $80 a barrel or higher. Editor's note, as of 2016, January, it's around $30 a barrel. Unable to absorb this flood of money locally, denominated in U.S. dollars, the oil-rich Arab world had to deposit it where it would earn income until it could be used internally in various projects. The money had to go out somewhere, and the main places it went was to the major banks of Europe, and particularly the largest banks of the United States. Faced with this huge influx of money, banks in turn needed to loan the money out so it could earn the interest the banks had to pay on it, plus a profit for the bank. The places that needed money the most and were willing to pay for it, or so they said, were chiefly developing countries such as Mexico, Brazil, Peru, Argentina, and several African nations. The Arab oil money poured into the banks, and the banks in turn poured it out to needy underdeveloped countries. It seemed to be a happy arrangement all around. But apparently many bank managers did not take the time to realistically consider how these debtor countries would pay back the money, given their social, economic, and political situations, along with the dishonesty of some government officials, almost a tradition in certain areas. Some of these loaned dollars were siphoned off by graft and corruption. Some money escaped the corruption and was invested in projects of various sorts, but many were poorly managed at best. Some were bad ideas to start with. Peru was one of the first countries to delay its debt repayment with the excuse that, quote, "These projects were so bad, you should have known better than to lend us money that we were asking for them," unquote. This is literally what they said. The longer-term balance of payments problem. Unfortunately, unlike Japan, which knew long ago it had to export to survive, the United States was content with its own large internal market and sufficient domestic mineral and energy mineral resources, oil, gas, coal, iron, copper, and others in initial abundance, for its own use. It did not need foreign exchange. But as U.S. oil self-sufficiency disappeared and the demand in the U.S. increased for fuel-efficient cars, Japan was able to build and export them to the U.S. In the decade of the 1980s, the U.S. went from the world's largest creditor nation to the world's largest debtor nation, with a huge foreign trade deficit. This was almost an unbelievable change of circumstances. Unable to sell enough to meet its import bill, the U.S. is running a large deficit and its international balance of payment in its international balance of payments. How long the situation can last is a serious question. Getting out of this economic hole will be a very large task. The U.S. balance of payments deficit for now exceeds $600 billion a year, with an internal debt of more than $15 trillion. The economic position of the United States may be as large an Achilles heel as its oil supply problem, and the two are closely related because oil imports, finished product and crude, are the single largest item in the deficit. U.S. domestic production, extraction, helps keep its oil bill from being even larger. Alaska's Prudhoe Bay field alone has saved the United States about $150 billion in oil import costs. Unfortunately, that field is already in extraction decline. Continuing transfer of wealth. The world payment for oil from consumer to producer, and editor's note, I will occasionally be using extractor or extraction instead of production and producer. I got that originally from William Catton, and I believe it's legitimate. And so when you hear me say extraction, he probably says in the text producing or producer. The worldwide payment for oil from consumer to producer is the largest transfer of wealth the world has ever seen. It will continue for decades to come. When or how it will come to an end, no one can say. But the world's money and the world's economic structure will never be the same again. Oil turned it upside down. It made some nations rich and others poor. The locations of the largest oil deposits will continue to have profound effects on the economic futures of industrialized countries and those trying to enter the age of oil. Because it is the largest user of oil on a per capita basis, the United States is particularly vulnerable. This continuing transfer of wealth to the oil-producing countries affects all citizens of resource-poor nations, even though they may be industrialized nations. It will ultimately be the citizens of these nations who will have to pay the bills in various ways through higher oil and mineral costs, and perhaps through having to rescue their banking systems. Higher taxes, a depreciated currency, higher prices for daily living needs, and a lower standard of living may accompany these costs. Oil, who has it and who does not, was and remains a major factor in these situations. It is important to consider the profound effects of a single commodity, oil, which less than 200 years ago was of no great importance to anyone. At that time, as it had been for several thousand years, one of oil's chief uses was in the Middle East, where numerous oil seeps existed. It was for the treatment of camel mange. In summary, minerals in the form of precious metals have served literally as money during much of modern civilization. In the form of oil and coal, iron, copper, uranium, and many other minerals that modern society needs, these materials are now responsible for an enormous transfer of wealth. Minerals are money in a fundamental sense. Who has them and who does not will continue to influence the course of national economies and, in turn, the destinies of nations. Because there are not enough precious metals in the world to back world currencies, paper money will continue to be the medium of exchange. Its value will fluctuate over time and from country to country as it is perceived by the world community to be backed by something of value. Other than gold and silver, important metals like iron and copper or fossil fuels or even agricultural products can help to support a currency. Money can also be backed by the intangible but important technical ability of a country to use raw materials to make things of value. The value of currency is a measure of a nation's ability to effectively manage both its internal and external finances. When a government inflates its currencies, citizens tend to convert paper currency money into almost anything tangible. Natural resources are the most common refuge from inflation. Land is another tangible inflation hedge. Both of these shelters are evident in various economies. It will take a nimble investor to successfully manage money in the decades ahead. Governments will struggle to finance the economic demands of increasing populations. Diminished resources in many countries will subject them to the problem of having to find a way to finance imports or to invest in costly, less economic substitutes for the cheaper resources of the past. The world's monetary systems are likely to be even more chaotic in the future than they have been in the past.